Okay, right, thanks. My name's Jed. I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't realize I've just been described as having a contradictory point of view. I didn't realize that. I certainly see myself as not that conventional. I do rail against certain groupthink, and I've always been reluctant to adopt any kind of conventional stuff, and I don't know why that is. I think it's been a deep need to be myself and to express myself, and that was stifled. That element of my being was kind of stifled. And I grew up kind of. I'm from. I was born in 1957. I was born into a very Catholic family, large family as usual with Catholics. I was one of seven kids, and I was always the slow one. I had some developmental problems as a kid, and I was always kind of there's a pecking order in most families, and my role, the family dynamic, that it was Jed, the slow coach. Slow in every way, and I adopted this identity of being not enough, inadequate, slow, not up to the mark. So that was my background, kind of ontology, really. I had no idea that this was going on at the time. This was just all very natural. It's just. From my point of view, it's just the way things were. And I fell absolutely hook, line, and sinker for this story about myself and acted accordingly. So I was very, as I say, I was slow at school. I couldn't read or write when I left school. I came bottom of the class every year in both primary school and secondary school, apart from one year when this bastard, Terence Gill, beat me to the bottom spot. And I was livid because that was my identity. That was kind of who I was. And it's tragic. I look back now at the confinement of that story, and it's just very oppressive and very contracting and very scary. And I spent most of my energy trying to present masks to the outside world. That it wasn't like that, that I was okay. So I was going through this pretense, and it took a lot of effort. And it also, every time I did that, there was a part of me that knew that that wasn't me. And strangely, it kind of reinforced my individual private view behind the mask. It reinforced that. So it's not like my life was without any happiness or fun. I had a lot of good times, but this was just the background narrative that was going on. And then I remember my mum got sick when I was 11. She got breast cancer, and it was chaos. Our family was it was chaos in our house. It really was. My mum was a complete neurotic. She was quite mad, actually, and she was very violent. But she got sick, and the family home was like, it was an awful place. It was an awful place to be. We got farmed out to different relatives while she was really sick to be looked after, and then when she got back from the hospital, and she remained sick, on and off. She had remissions, but she remained sick for the next 6 years, and she died when I was 17. But it was a very, very difficult family home. It was macabre, actually. Anyway, so when I was 40, I was on the way to the local youth club with my friends, and one of my friends climbed over the back of a bottle shop. They're called off licenses in the UK. And some guy had left a crate of woodpecker cider, full bottle. And so we got the crate, over the fence, and we all sat near the river drinking this woodpecker cider on the way to the youth club. And it was, I've said this a long, I say this every time, but it really was transformative. It really changed me in a way that I'd never experienced. It was the most free and the most, it was the opposite of this contracted self and this preoccupation with self and trying to be concerned about how others saw me. All of that was dialed down. And there was a sense of real freedom. And I thought, mistakenly, the booze gave me that freedom. I look back on it now and I see it the other way. All it did, it removed the barrier. It removed the thing that was blocking that innate freedom. I didn't see that at the time. And we were in the dance hall. It was disco night. It was a community shed. And it was fluorescent lights everywhere and a big disco ball. And all the girls on one side, all the boys on the other. And I wanted to dance because Otis Redding was playing. I love Otis Redding. And I just found myself, I didn't even think about it, I just found myself walking across an empty dance floor to the girls' section. And I said to this girl, do you want to dance? And she looked, and this is in front of everyone. And there wasn't an ounce of shyness, or it was like they all vanished in my mind. It was a real freedom. And she pulled her chewing gum out of her mouth and wrapped it round her finger. And she said, nah. And rather than be a wreck at this public rejection, I genuinely felt sorry. I thought, oh, you poor thing, you don't know what you're missing. And I asked her friend, I said, do you want to dance? And she said, yeah, okay. So me and this girl are dancing to Otis Redding. And then the dance floor started to fill up. And I'm thinking, my God, this woodpecker cider. This is the stuff for me. So that idea was firmly cemented in my psyche. And now I had a solution to the problem of being Jed. So I thought, and it really felt like, and in fact, in the early days, it genuinely was a solution. It gave me some space to breathe and it gave me a taste. I didn't know, as I said, all of this is in hindsight, but it gave me a taste of how my life can be without this oppressive propaganda bullshit story that I had going. Anyway, I left school without any qualifications. It was a difficult time of life as well, because Mum was really sick and she was at home. She took a long time to die. In fact, she was dying. My mother should not have been kept. She shouldn't have been kept alive, actually. As long as she, not in the condition she was in. And it was just awful. So I was escaping. I felt I was escaping the family home. And I felt so guilty about that. But I had to, I just couldn't bear it. And I just lived around for parties and to just escape into an alternative world of drinking and being reckless. And just when I was drinking, it was as though consequences didn't actually exist. That's how it felt. I mean, I know objectively they existed, but from a first person perspective, they were just, I became really kind of myopic. And I was just kind of interested in now having a good time. And all of the other elements of life and reality somehow weren't in my field of vision. And that's what I was looking for. It was a bit like an ostrich with its head in the sand. But the consequences for my drinking started to manifest. One of them was, I've always been an anxious kid. But this now was really dialed up into a full-blown anxiety disorder that would manifest as panic attacks. And I didn't even know the term panic attacks. I and my friends would refer to this as a turn. I'd say to my friends, oh, just give me a bit of space, I'm having a turn. And my friends would say, oh, Jed, just give Jed a few minutes, he's having one of his turns. And these panic attacks, I didn't know what they were I had no label, but I found that a few drinks would sort those out. So now it was booze became the seeming solution for everything. And I developed this absolute dependency and trust that booze would not solve problems. I've never been in the problem solving business in my life. I've been in the problem avoiding business. And that's what booze was. And I kind of knew it. And also there was part of me I always knew this, that there would be a price to pay eventually, because I was trying to adopt this play now, pay later approach. And I was trying to bullshit myself with that. But deep down, there was an intuitive part of me that knew that this was not sustainable. And it certainly wasn't in my case. My mother died, and I remember actually we lived in a cul-de-sac, and I came home from work and I looked at our house, and the curtains were closed. So I knew mum had died, and she was expected to die. She'd been given, the doctors constantly said, oh, she's not going to make the weekend. They were saying that for over a fucking year. But the curtains were closed and mum had died. And I remember this feeling, that almost like a tsunami of emotion rising. And I felt this disconnection in my chest, like I'd emotionally, literally disconnected, unplugged from it. And then I had this kind of almost like numb feeling. There was no emotion at all. There was nothing going on. There were just kind of thoughts without any valence of emotion. And I remember thinking, oh, how do I act in this situation, with the word act underlined? And I walked into the house and my father met me and he embraced me and he had tears in his eyes. He said, oh, your mum died about 3 hours ago. So I started to cry, and it was like an Oscar performance. I had tears rolling down my face, and I was crying because most of the family were crying. And I remember thinking, my God, you should be an actor, as I've been doing it. And for absolute years, I beat myself up for that, tortured myself. I thought, you fucking piece of work, you can't even feel the enormity of your mum's death. And I'd be, because that was part of my MO, beating myself up and berating myself and ridiculing myself. And it was only years later that a psychiatrist told me that that was a very normal response, that people deal with grief in vastly different ways. And it was such a relief to put that burden down. And that was a big part of my step five, that particular incident. Anyway, so to continue with the story, I joined the army. The reason why I joined the army, I was an apprentice electrician, and Margaret Thatcher was in power at the time. And there was something about the miners. She was having a ding dong with the miners strike, and Britain went on a 3-day working week to save fuel, and so a lot of small contracting firms were closed down, including mine. So I just got out of my apprenticeship, and I got made redundant. So I was doing what I usually do with difficult situations. I'm sitting in a pub, thinking, what am I going to do about this? You know, getting pissed. And then in England, the licensing laws are, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they close the pubs and they have to close for 2 hours, then they can reopen them. So you've got to find something to do for 2 hours. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do for 2 hours before the pubs open again? So I walked out of the pub and it was drizzling rain as usual in Manchester, England. And there was an army careers office outside with big photographs, massive big photographs of guys climbing around tanks with spanners and AVOs. I thought, I'll go and join the army. And that was like a good 10 seconds thought went into that. And I walked in and I was pissed, but they didn't care. There were shorter people in the army. So I signed up for the army, and I fucking hated the army from the moment I got in there. And maybe that's part of my nonconformity, or that was mentioned earlier. Maybe that's, I just can't stand this kind of, because in the army, there's a real groupthink. And uniformity is the name of the game, literally. And I fucking couldn't deal with that. And I was like a square peg in a round hole. Anyway, I won't go into the incidents that happened. Well, I'll just tell you one. I'll tell you one incident. I was stationed in Germany. And by this stage, my drinking was out of control. And in the army, you can disguise that because they're big drinkers in the army. And they had this squadron bar in the attic of an army barracks. This is in Germany. Six-floor army barracks with a massive big roof. And they converted the roof space into a squadron bar. And I came home from the local town, Hamel, in Germany, at 3 o'clock in the morning because they closed the bars. And on the way back, I thought, because I've got no off switch, I just wanted to continue drinking. So I thought, I'll go and break into the bar. And I was just, so I walked up to the stairs and I broke into the front door. And to my horror, they'd erected a security bar between for the bar itself. I thought, shit. And it had been raining that night. So I got out onto the roof through this dormer window and I scaled across the roof. 60 degree pitch roof. If I would have fallen, there's no way you could survive that. That was absolutely shit faced. And then I broke into the window that was the right side of the bar, as far as I was concerned. And now I'm in and I've got a cigar from somewhere. I'm drinking brandies. My God. And then the next morning, the MPs arrived, opened the security shutters, and that's another 28 days in the military. And I spent loads of time in the jail. For going AWOL and for fighting with senior officers, and eventually they threw me out. And the commanding officer when I got dishonorably discharged, you march in to get your discharge. And this brigadier, I think it was a brigadier, and he pulled his bifocal glasses and he said, "You know, Field," he says, "you're not a bad person, but there's something seriously wrong with you." It was the way you said it. I thought, ain't that the truth? And that was it. So I left the army, went to live in London. Couldn't find accommodation. I was couch surfing. I was very parasitic by that because the army had looked after me and I couldn't look after myself. And I just, from then it really nosedived. And it was wall-to-wall panic attacks. Honestly, this panic disorder by now had ramped up to a debilitating level. I couldn't travel on the tube train in London, the London Underground. I couldn't get in elevators. I couldn't get on a pub. I couldn't get on a bus. Or I walked everywhere. And several times a day, I would have huge panic attacks. And then I'd be drinking to try to. So that was my life. And anyway, the bottom line is that employment was out. Relationships were out. Paying rent was out. I tried that, and I ended up living on the streets. And I'm not equipped. I'm not the most street-wise person, and I just wasn't equipped. And I should have been in a psychiatric unit, genuinely. But I was just begging for money and eating out of bins and sleeping on cardboard slabs. And terrified. And then one day I remember I woke up in this doorway and I'll never forget it. There was all of these thousands of legs because I was at pavement level and they were all commuting to the train station. And I had some sherry left in a bottle. And I remember saying, I was screaming at this crowd because I felt so alone and so on the outside. I felt on the outside of life in a very contracted, horrible hell of my own. And I was screaming this because I was so scared and angry. But I remember catching myself screaming at these people. TikTok, TikTok, 9-to-5 wankers. And then I kind of caught myself. I had a view of myself from somewhere with clarity. And I just thought, I can't go on like this. Is just, you know, I saw my insanity in full flight and got to a meeting. I went to a meeting that night because I had heard about AA. I just didn't think, I don't know. I just couldn't imagine life without booze, strangely, even though it was a nightmare. And I stood in the doorway of this meeting with my black plastic bag with everything I owned. They allowed me to stand in the doorway and I just, I just stood there looking at them I was really grateful that they didn't insist that I came into the room because I would have scarpered. I could not have gone into the room. And it occurred to me years later that they probably allowed that willingly because I smelled so bad. Didn't occur to me at the time. But these people, all of them, talked about that space behind the mask. They didn't talk about the usual social chit-chat about putting your best foot forward and displaying different ranks and different social, you know, it wasn't that at all. There was something very human and very deep. People were speaking about their first person, what it was like to be them. That's what they were speaking about. And I've never heard anything like it. And I felt so at home and so safe. And they also, this is what struck me that day. It felt to me like they could see some intrinsic value in me that I couldn't see. But it was apparent to me that they could see something. And they were saying things like, you know, keep coming back and, if you want to be someone, just be yourself, and you're enough. Marcia says it a lot. That was the kind of basic message, that there was something about me that I had completely wrong. And this fella said at the end of the meeting, I asked him what it was about. He came and had a chat with me, and he said, "Well, AA considers drinking a symptom of deeper troubles." And the trick is to deal with the symptom first. And what they mean by that is just to prioritize getting to bed tonight without a drink. In other words, separating me from booze is the first essential prerequisite. And to prioritize doing that. And then he said, but the second phase of it is the real deal. It's about embarking on a journey inwards and getting honest and getting comfortable and accepting the fellow that was doing the drinking. And it was that bit that freaked me out. I said, fucking hell, mate. I said, anywhere but there. Because I hated myself. I would have given anything to be anybody but me. But this fellow became our sponsor. He was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And he's alive. He's been dead now for years. But he's alive and kicking. He's right here with me. He had some wonderful turns of phrase. He was a really funny bloke. He was a very intelligent bloke. Such a kind man. And he only ever spoke to me about his first person experience. He put me onto the pamphlet, A Member's Eye View, in that first week. And that was the first bit of AA literature I could ever really read. And it made me cry, and it still does. I can't read that pamphlet from cover to cover without crying. And I remember the Just for Today card as well. That was fantastic, and I read that many times a day. And I started to my look changed. I think it was about 5 months. I think about 5 months after I got sober, a friend of mine saw me in the street. He said, "Oh, I've got a letter for you, Jed, at my place." And he said he's been there for months. So I went round and got the letter, Maybe 4 years prior to this, I'd applied for what's known as a housing association flat in London. And there was a letter, and it said, "A flat's become available. Would you care to go and view it?" Bloody hell. So I got this flat now, and I got a job, and so I've now got a base, and this flat was located about literally 45 meters from a meeting in a church. And about 2 months after I moved in, one of the nuns who operated the building, she said to me, "Do any of your AA friends have a van we could borrow? Because we've got all this furniture that's been donated and we can't keep it any longer because our insurance policy has changed." So anyway, I ended up that night with the whole meeting carrying furniture from the meeting to my flat. And it was just wonderful, about 30 people carrying. So I got a cooker, I got a bed, I got sofa, curtains, pans. Talk about luck changing. And I just really got into AA. I was really, really loved AA. And I met a woman after a few years, Leanne. Got married to Leanne, wonderful person. My life just really, Pat often said that Pat's got a lovely phrase. He says that when he stopped drinking, probably 75% of his problems cleared up. And that was true for me, that things just naturally started to fall into place. Like I learned to be punctual, learned to be reliable. I learned for me that I could be reliable. I started to trust myself. I started to like myself. I used to take myself out for lunch for years. I would take myself out on my own deliberately on a Sunday and take a book or something nice and go and find a relatively cheaply priced restaurant or something. But because Raja used to say to me, "Get the best for yourself, Jed, because you're worth it." And if you don't believe that, you're going to be in serious trouble. So this journey, for me, is one of reconciliation. It's one of finding out who I really am and dropping the bullshit story about who I thought I was and recognizing that deep down, I've always been enough. That I can now see the intrinsic value in myself that those people could see. And that's not from the ego perspective. It's deeper than that. I don't know what to call it. But it's that unsuspected inner resource of, and when I'm living from that space and when I'm cultivating that space, my life is, it doesn't, the external circumstances aren't necessarily the thing that change. But what changes is that I've got a capacity to deal with whatever's happening, whereas the converse of that was true. I felt there was a vacuum at best here, and at worst, I was rotten to the core. There was nothing I had in the way of agency or inner resources to deal with anything. That's why I was looking externally for a solution, i.e. booze. So for me, AA is a way of finding that freedom that I found when I was 14 through the program, through the journey of honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, connecting, you know, and getting myself sort of getting that story dialed down so I can truly connect in the way that I truly connected in that youth club that day. I kind of disappeared. I got myself out of the way for the first time in my life. But it was done chemically. The default mode network in my brain was dialed down so I could be my true self. And I think AA is about that. It's about dialing down the impediments. AA calls them defects of character. I don't like that language, but that's okay. The things that impair this freedom, but they feel secure. That's the elusive thing. They feel like that's where my security is. So for me, it's like an identity shift. After many years of being sober, and now I'm starting to get pretty well-to-do, at least in my case. So now I'm driving around in Mercedes, and I've got myself a really big house, and I'm buying and selling places in London. And I'm almost breaking my arm, patting myself on the back, I'm doing that well. And now I've got another story running that I didn't realize, that I've gone from Jed the loser to Jed the success. And I started believing that veneer. So the core of me is neither of those things. The core of me is not to do with failure, success. The core of me is just fine as it is. Doesn't need any external verification or validation. But we live in a world where we're taught that propaganda endlessly, as though these things are the thing, anything that's quantifiable or measurable or showable or displayable. If my identity drifts back there in the foreground, I cut myself off from this kind of space that I'm trying to describe. I wasn't working. I don't like the term working on myself either. I wasn't applying. I like the Socrates thing. The unexamined life isn't worth living. That nails it for me. I wasn't examining myself to the extent that I had become kind of used to. And I was now externally focused on dollars or pounds in my case. And then my relationship with Leanne started to deteriorate. I started to get miserable. So when things weren't going well, that was the be all and end all. So my happiness was now contingent on what was going on externally, because the internal space had been neglected again. So you all know where this is leading, of course, because I think that having a slip is a strange concept, and the drinking is the end of the slip. This is my experience. This is my history. This isn't a theory for anyone else. I'm simply telling you about me. That's all I've got to offer. My experience is that drinking is the end of a slip, and the slip happened a long time before the drink. Anyway, the bottom line is I started drinking, and it was within an hour or two, literally within an hour or two, it was horrific. It was like I re-remembered with the full impact. My God, what the fuck are you doing? And the answer to that was have another drink. And I'm off again now, because that's what I don't have an off switch. Now I'm kind of up and running. And I think it was about 6 or 7 weeks later, me and Leanne were in Amsterdam of all places. And my last drink was in Amsterdam over a breakfast table. It was about 6:30 in the morning. And Leanne's trying to eat a piece of toast and drink some coffee to get on a flight back to London. And I've got this glass of scotch, and I'm trying to nurse this scotch into my system so I can get on the flight, because now I've got this wall-to-wall panic attack back. And I'll never forget the look in Leanne's eyes, because she knew I was an alcoholic, obviously, when I married her, you know. But she knew I was an alcoholic theoretically. And now she knew I was an alcoholic actually. And the look and the smell and the reality of it all. And the look in her eyes, it felt like that piece of shit was back. From my point of view, I thought, yeah. And it felt like all of that work, all of that good stuff, all of that stuff that was wonderful had been, yeah, but this is, you're back to who you really are now, Jed. And that self-condemnation was savage, savage. To the point that we got back to London and got back into AA on a Tuesday night. Everything happens to me on a Tuesday night. And that was my last drink, that scotch. And then about 6 months later, I had a nervous breakdown, because now I felt like a complete failure, even in AA. The one thing that I valued, the one thing I did in my life of any that I'm really pleased about, and I knew was that I'd even blown that. And I was beating myself up mercilessly into a nervous breakdown. And then I had this moment. I had this moment where I was going to run a knife across my throat in the kitchen. And I don't know why it was, but I just found myself in a similar way. Weirdly, it was a similar thing like my mother's death. There was no emotion involved. I was like on autopilot, even no thinking involved. And I just grabbed the dog lead and I got the dog and I took the dog for a walk. And I had this moment of, I can't describe it, absolute peace. From a few minutes ago, I was just about to run a knife across my throat. Now I've got the dog and I'm out and I'm walking and the sun was coming through the trees and I felt this overwhelming peace. And the kind of sentiment that was going, it was almost like war is over. The war is over. And I kind of fully accepted, I think. I think that's what it was. I think what happened, if I'm really honest, I don't think I could keep going anymore. I was exhausted with beating myself up and I was at literally the end of my rope and I stopped just for a moment in time. I kind of ran out of juice and just being stopped from this incessant self-criticism felt like such a relief and such a joy. And that feeling's never left me, actually. So it was almost like me re-emerging and saying, I'm going to take over now. Enough of that crap. So, anyway, so really kind of, I'm lucky. I'm a really lucky fella to have survived that. And so I've got a great daughter. We came to Australia because I didn't want to bring Evie up in London because London was going down the pan. So we came to Australia, probably how long ago? 19 years ago. And it was just a great move. I mean, I really miss my AA friends in England, but, and I got to Australia and it's just a fantastic place. However, the AA in Australia, from my point of view, is very, oppressive and kind of insistent that it's kind of one size fits all message. And if you're not singing from the correct hymn sheet, you don't get invited to share. And over here in Australia, you don't share by your own volition. You have to be invited by the chairperson. So it's a way of centering people like me, so who sound contradictory or contrarian or whatever, however I sound. But anyway, that's a long story to go into, but. When I found secular groups about, I don't know, a couple of years ago now, 2.5 years ago, it was like, it reminded me of the early days in the 80s in London, where it was very, you know, if you want to be someone, be yourself. And it was a kind of, not just a permission, but an inclusiveness of people seeing things differently and expressing things differently. I think that's the way it should be. If we're speaking about our own subjective journeys, then it's only right and proper that everyone expresses it differently. We've all got different journeys. And that's wonderful. It's not to be feared. And so I'm really grateful. I'll just finish on this. About 8 years ago, Leanne decided she wanted to get a divorce. And I was shattered, truly shattered by that. And I went into a big depression, a big nosedive. And I, again, this thing about identity, I had no idea how much my identity was meshed with this idea of me, Jed, being a married fella. Been married for 27 years to Leanne. And it was a big, it was a really big deal. Really big deal. And I had to go to hospital with depression because I've had depression on and off all my life. And it was as dark as could be. But there was this, again, how dark it is before the dawn. It's always like that with me. When I get to these real dark places, my sponsor said to me once, and it was when I came back from that relapse and just before my nervous breakdown, I phoned him up. I phoned Mac. The guy was called Mac this time because Roger died. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I phoned him on speed dial. And when I went to speak, I couldn't speak. I was because I've had some mental health problems with depression and anxiety, really severe stuff. I'm not talking about just having the blues, but genuinely bad news. And I couldn't speak. And Mac said these words. I've never forgotten these words because Mac had been through the ringer. He said, "I'm going to take a chance that this is Jed." And I couldn't answer him. And he said to me these words. He said, "Jed, hold your face to the light, even if for the moment you can't see." And I don't know why, but those words were like a life raft. It was as though I knew that Mac had been to hell in his own life, and I was currently in hell. And he was like reaching in and offering me this message from the outside. And I trusted that, and it kept me going that night. So I'm that kind of person. I go really dark, and then I have breakthroughs. And Leanne and I now are fantastic friends, genuine friends. I mean, I look after her animals, her pets, and stay around there, dog sitting and cat sitting. And Evie, my daughter, we're like a family in a different dynamic. We are the reconciliation. After that difficult divorce, which was bad for 18 months, really bad. But so it's amazing what AA can do. AA can reconcile anything. It can reconcile me with myself, me with other people. Once I tune into and live from who I truly am, rather than veneer of who I think I am, there's such a confidence that I have in that. And it's greater than any confidence I had in booze. I had real confidence in booze that sorted me out, and I was wrong about that. But this confidence back here is always available, always reliable. I just keep losing sight of it. And that will always be the case. That's not the problem. You know, like I will continue to lose sight of it. But I've got a place to return home right here. And it was all courtesy of AA, because when I arrived at AA, I knew I was home. I knew it. It was the most certain thing I've ever known. And people could see that intrinsic value that they could see in me, I can now see it. And that's a game changer. How long was that? I think that's about as long as I can speak for now. Oh, actually, let me just try and finish with this, if you don't mind. I'll try. I wish I can find this. I know other people have read this, but I just think that this for me is the most beautiful thing. It's a piece from a member's eye view. And that's why I changed my name, actually, to a Jed's eye view. It says here, I am personally... So it's all about the outside veneer, or the things that we display. Anyway, and it's contrasting that with the real person. It says, I'm personally convinced that the basic search of every human being from cradle to grave is to find at least one other human being before whom he can stand completely naked, stripped of all pretense or defense, and trust that person not to hurt him, because that other person has stripped himself naked too. This lifelong search can begin to end with the first encounter with AA. And I just love that, because that really... it kind of encapsulates what happened to me. So thanks very much.